China is the world's second largest economy and home to more than 1.4 billion people. Economic power is translating into growing military power, and China is now contesting US dominance of its seaboard and beyond. But there's much more than that to the story. China is a land of growing inequality with more billionaires than the US. Much of that wealth has flowed into property speculation, and some of China's biggest developers are staring down the barrel of bankruptcy. And while Western media draws attention to the appalling treatment of the Uyghurs, a Muslim minority in Xinjiang province, there's much less said about the oppressive situation for Chinese workers. So how do socialists make sense of this situation without falling into one of two traps, either excusing the crimes of the Chinese state or whitewashing the hypocrisy of the West, including Australia? Today, my guest is Phil Griffiths. Phil is a former lecturer in political economy at the University of Southern Queensland and a member of Solidarity. And he's visited China many times, most recently just before the pandemic. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity. We're a revolutionary socialist group in Australia, and if you'd like to find out more about us, our website is solidarity.net.au. I'm David Glanz, and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Naam or Melbourne. So Phil, welcome.
Hey.
China has been an enormous economic success story over the past 40 to 50 years. So why has President Xi Jinping started to talk about something called, quotes, common prosperity, and to crack down on some of the super rich?
I think the first thing to say is that common prosperity is not a new slogan for the Communist Party in China. The current shift, I think, is best explained in a recent book where the Secretary of the Central Political and Legal Affairs Commission, which is the top Communist Party agency in charge of law enforcement, said that common prosperity was aimed at solving, quote, deep-rooted risk and hidden peril caused by uneven income distribution. In other words, improving regulations for suppressing illegal incomes, regulating income distribution, were now central issues for this commission, which is not an economic or a fiscal body, but essentially a police and security agency. In other words, income inequality, the regime is seeing income inequality as a, if you like, as a threat of unrest, of instability, and of political crisis. And I think to understand it, we need to see that this reflects some of the fundamental contradictions of Chinese state capitalism. On the one hand, we have the explosive growth of Chinese capitalism in the last 30 years, which is unprecedented in human history. It was driven by extremely high rates of profit, especially in manufacturing, which in part came from globalization and China joining the World Trade Organization. It opened up the global market for China's capitalists. That huge profits selling to the world, not just locally, invested in more and more sophisticated manufacturing. And then, you know, basically, you know, a lot of the world's manufacturing now takes place in China as a result of this incredible success, this incredible capitalist success. But on the other hand, this economic boom has been described by Xi Jinping as unleashing inequality, corruption, risky asset bubbles, moral decadence, and other problems. So you've got, on the one hand, the greatest number of billionaires in the world, as you said before. You've got raised living standards for ordinary people, again, at a rate unprecedented in human history. A relatively large, prosperous middle class, business people, professionals, government officials. That's fired up domestic business expansion. You've had high quality clothing produced, food, real estate, hospitality, restaurants, education, all of this has opened up the door for all kinds of speculation and corruption. So the thing to understand about the economy is that inequality has risen dramatically, even as living standards have grown. And this has reflected the relative success of Chinese capitalism in the kind of era of globalization. And so the government knows that this is a powder keg, that inequality fuels social discontent and hostility to the rich. It also fuels corruption, which in turn fuels hostility and distrust of the government, And that has spilled over into all kinds of direct action. You know, village protests against land being grabbed for industrial or real estate development, strikes over pay, working conditions, and so on. And it's a political system with very few safety valves to contain that discontent. Now, it's important to realise this is not a new problem for the regime. The first time I went to China was in 2011, just over 2 years ago. And that was at the time of the global Occupy movement against inequality and the 1% who grabbed most of the wealth and who rule our lives. And of course, this started off in New York and then spread globally. Now, I went to China, to Wuhan, to attend an international conference on income inequality being held at a university. Now, one of the keynote speakers was a senior academic administrator, like a vice president of one of the major universities, and obviously a senior party figure. He got up and he said, "We've got the worst of capitalism and the worst of socialism. If we don't deal with inequality, we'll have Occupy in China." And I can't tell you, like, that speech changed my life, both because he was able to say it publicly, which is not what I expected, but also, too, because of the sense that the regime saw that it was facing a crisis. And this was a year before Xi became president. And things have only got worse for the regime since then in terms of inequality and the instability of capitalist boom. So how do they deal with this problem of inequality? Well, there's a number of things they can do. They can improve living standards for the poor. They can improve housing and services, especially for 100 million people who still live in poor villages. And actually, the regime has put a lot of resources into this. And the life of poor farmers in China is much better than it was, by and large. There are some exceptions. And, of course, way better than poor farmers in India and other developing countries. But rural life for hundreds of millions of people remains incredibly impoverished compared to life in the cities, much less life for the rich. They can improve welfare payments the poor, and especially for retired workers. Pensions are unbelievably low, but that would require revenue. They could increase taxes on the rich, but Chinese capitalism, like Western capitalism, relies on private businesses investing, and raising taxes will only hold that back. And in fact, a recent article showed that taxes in China did rise significantly from the mid-1990s to the mid-2010s, when profit rates were higher. But since then, under Xi, taxes on the rich have actually fallen significantly, again, because of the fact that the expansion of Chinese capitalism is starting to run into the limits of, that imposed by, the falling rates of profit, the difficulty, extracting more surplus value from workers, and so on. The government can use laws and regulations and repression to crack down on undesirable behaviour and excessive wealth, use internal discipline to force officials to create, outcomes of more, more equality. But there's a long history of officials doing terrible things to please their bosses and, create these outcomes, in turn creating huge discontent. So I think the point I'm trying to get across is that the regime faces what is essentially an insoluble dilemma, and it is trying to work its way around it. And it's really, I think the common prosperity strategy is just a new attempt to try to make things happen. So it's wrestling essentially with the same problem that Western governments face. It's really very much a mirror of it. So capitalism is a system of crisis, of inequality, exploitation, of course, revolution. And this is, they're just trying to deal with that same problem, as I said, that Western governments are facing. Now, my reading of common prosperity is that it contains three elements. The first is propaganda. The second is a headline for a series of limited measures. And third, a series of guidelines for party and government officials to experiment with possible measures to deal with the worst elements of capitalist instability. So the propaganda element is telling people that the rich are being expected to contribute to society and give away some of their wealth. And so we've seen some very, very well-publicised examples of very rich businesses and individuals giving huge amounts of money, multi-million dollar gifts to charity and for flood relief and so on and so forth. The government has also been cracking down on those who flaunt their wealth, especially media celebrities. Again, it has nothing to do with actual inequality, but is an attempt to reduce the political impact of it. Some years ago, in an earlier version of the same kind of policy, they clamped down on excessive hospitality spending, and especially the very visible corruption involved in extravagant banquets given to government officials as payback for supporting this or that business proposition. The real measures are a real mixture. You know, there's a clampdown on tech companies, but a lot of that, I think, is actually driven by concern of having huge monopolies control major sectors of the economy, and also by security considerations, which are central to every government's regulation of social media and IT. But an example of the problem of repressive measures is from a couple of months ago, the government suddenly shut down almost the entire tutoring industry, like tutoring, you know, school students, all those companies that help students cram for exams in what is an incredibly competitive education sector. And the reason these businesses have grown is that to get a good job in the future, a young person needs to go to a good uni. That requires a high exam score, and that's hard to get unless you go to a good school. And entry into good schools is mostly through getting high exam scores from primary school. It's not a very socialist system, as you can tell. So, or of course, your parents might send you to a very expensive private school. So this created this absolutely vast tutoring industry. But what it meant was, of course, that, you know, vast majority of the population couldn't afford to send their kids to these schools. So these were basically a way of middle class and early class people, you know, guaranteeing their kids would get a head start in life. And so the government just basically closed this industry down virtually overnight. And that basically meant that there were multi-billion dollar companies, some of whom had listed on the New York Stock Exchange, were literally just shut down. Over a million tutors lost their jobs. Now, my reading is it was pretty popular, but it created incredible anger among tens of millions of middle-class parents. And so it's another example of the government attempting to deal with this problem, the instability created by a capitalist competition, capitalist boom, the accumulation of capital, try to deal with the instability, the chaos that creates, using repressive measures to do it. But that aren't really going to solve the problem. I mean, getting rid of the tutoring industry isn't going to deal with the problems of the instability of the Chinese capitalism at the moment. And so I think that's what you've got. You've got a government that is basically wrestling with this problem, using all kinds of arbitrary measures, propaganda to try to contain the problem. But really, there's no simple way out for them.
That's a really useful overview as an introduction to this podcast. Let's unbundle it a little bit further. You talked about the danger of bubbles in the economy, and bubbles burst, and economic bubbles, when they burst, hurt people. Now, the Evergrande Property Development Group has been in the news even in the West because it's on the verge of going bust, and it has debts of more than $300 billion, and it is apparently once again tottering on the brink. It's not the only development company in that kind of situation. Now, bankruptcy could have huge consequences, not just for Evergrande workers, construction workers, and so on, but also for many ordinary Chinese people, because as you mentioned, either they don't get pensions or the pensions are so poor that they have to save and invest for their old age. And investing in property, a bit like in Australia, has become a very, very popular pastime. So, if Evergrande goes bust, what does that mean?
I think Evergrande is going to go bust, I think. But I think it's really a question of how they go broke. Clearly, the Chinese government, and this is a real example of how the Chinese government is caught between a rock and a hard place, managing capitalist accumulation in China. So I think the government's strategy is to unwind Evergrande. Essentially, the way that a lot of the, like if you go back to think of the financial crisis in Australia in the late 1980s, both the government and the banks attempted to unwind the speculative boom of the 1980s without creating too much risk in the financial sector. So I think what the government is going to do is that it is going to work to ensure that the people who've paid money to Evergrande to get an apartment actually get an apartment. And I think it will it may well act to save the investments of some investors or some people who've lent money to the group, mostly the international and Chinese sophisticated investors, banks and so on who've lent to Evergrande may well end up losing all or most of their money. In other words, the government wants to avoid, this is the government strategy, whether or not it actually succeeds is an entirely different question. They want to avoid a bailout that means that the people who created the problem walk away with millions and billions of accumulated profits. And they've actually, the founder of Evergrande, who at one stage had a fortune estimated at something like $50 billion, is being expected to stump up his fortune to bail out the enterprise, and we don't know where that'll go. Certainly there is a risk of financial contagion. But again, because the Chinese financial system is not an open financial system, the government essentially controls it, I think that they have the capacity to manage this deleveraging. Evergrande is just the tip of the iceberg. The shadow banking system in China is absolutely staggering. It's lent far more money to local governments with limited assets than it has into the construction sector. And again, the government is attempting to unwind a lot of that debt, roll back a lot of that debt, and reduce the systemic risks involved. Okay, but I don't think that is the main issue. The main issue here is that the construction boom in China has actually been a major provider of jobs and profits, jobs for workers and profits for business. By some measures, construction is 30% of the economy, which is a staggering amount of the economy. And so I think in some ways the most important thing at stake here are literally tens of millions of jobs in the construction industry. If you look at Western capitalist crises, often there'll be some kind of, you know, real estate bubble and then bust that fuels the crisis, that was, you know, sparks it. It wasn't the cause of the Great Depression, but certainly the Florida boom and bust were a major factor in driving the American economy up to its peak in the late 1920s and then, of course, down to the depths of the Depression. And that's because when you have a property bubble, you get this inordinate growth of the construction sector. And then, of course, when you get the bust, it contracts dramatically, rapidly, and you've got all this unemployment and demand for other businesses collapses, profits collapse, and so on. So I think that's the biggest issue here. And if you look at the recent speeches by Xi Jinping and some of the commentary, you can see that they want to wind back this speculative construction, but they also want to make sure there is what they call affordable housing. So their slogan at the moment is, you know, housing is for living in, not for speculation. But exactly how they do that is hard to know. I think this is one concrete example of what is essentially an insoluble problem.
And of course, the government's ability to try and muddle its way through this with its authority intact is the integrity and the standing of the Chinese Communist Party, which has millions of members. And obviously, there's an attitude amongst many people, or a reality, that there's a fair degree of corruption. And since February, the party has disciplined more than 170,000 officials and secretly detained nearly 3,000 of them as part of a campaign to rectify China's law enforcement and judiciary. Is this a sign of the party's strength, or is this a sign of its weakness and its vulnerability to some kind of popular backlash?
I think it's both. One of the most stupid ways to try to understand Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party is to look at their speeches and assume that they, you know, Xi Jinping says, you know, we're going to, you know, build more confidence in the party, and just assume that he's able to do this. I think when you read the speeches and so on and the party directives, what you see, all the things they want to do are actually reflecting weaknesses and problems. And so when they say they're going to, you know, insist on, you know, loyalty to the party now being central to, all teachers have to profess their loyalty to the party, not just to the nation, as traditionally. And children, primary school children, are taught to be loyalty to the party, not just loyalty to the nation. I just see that as a reflection of the weakness of the party ideologically rather than any strength. So clearly you're right. I mean, there are very, very real problems here. And of course, there are many, many reasons for those problems, not least, of course, the fact that it is a country of 1.4 billion people. I mean, Xi Jinping as president, I mean, what is it, 34 provinces, I think, in China. Most of them, many of them, you know, have populations bigger than, you know, the average European country, you know, 50, 60, 80 million. Guangdong in the south has a population of 125 million. It's like a province, but its population is bigger than a significant, you know, all but the very biggest nations on earth. How does Xi Jinping control the Guangdong party and government? How does the Guangdong party control the governments of all the cities in Guangdong? It's a monumental task. And what I think a lot of the rhetoric leaves out is that the pressures facing those officials are coming from below in terms of what local capitalists demand, what local people demand. They're coming from above in terms of the centre says, here's what you have to achieve. And, you know, the business of getting officials to do what you want is enormously difficult. And the centre is nowhere near as powerful as Western media makes it out to be. I think in terms of how ordinary people see the party, I think the starting point is to, we have to use the word party, but it is nothing like a political party in the West. You know, it's not like it's a party that fights for election or has members who want to join the party to be elected to parliament or council or whatever. It's much more like a cadre organisation of government. I think just everyone in China sees joining the party as a way of getting ahead, getting a better job. Most of those that I've talked to who joined the party also see it as a way of serving the nation. So, you know, people have this kind of multiple objectives. You know, I want to get ahead. I want a better job. You know, I don't want to miss out on the best job. At the same time, you know, I love the country. I want to see it prosper, et cetera, et cetera. The majority of people, I think the people almost universally see the party as having liberated the country from Japanese invasion and Western imperialism and having presided over this extraordinary economic development, which, you know, as I said, is historically unprecedented. And so that nationalism in China is very, very real. Like, the most popular film in China at the moment, which is one of the most popular films ever made in China, is a film called The Battle of Lake Changjin, which I doubt that we'll see in Australia. It's a Korean War epic that is all about, you know, the brave, self-sacrificing Chinese military pushing back an American offensive during the Korean War. And, of course, it's just a dreadful sort of film. But you know, people are paying money. You know, people are not forced to go and watch these films. People are paying money to go and see this film. I think it reflects, you know, something very real in the way Chinese people see themselves as well as the party. Among professionals, those who join and those who don't join, they dislike the regime's authoritarianism, but they also believe it's the only way China can be stable, that the alternative would be chaos. The party has very, very real roots in that sense in society. Outside the party, you know, people, you know, just accept its existence. There's many, many dislikers. And they dislike the things that I think, you know, you could expect. They dislike the careerism, which is a reason to join. They dislike the corruption. They dislike people they know spouting rubbish slogans. They dislike the two-facedness of, you know, officials, the yawning chasm between the so-called principles of socialism and the behaviour of party members. So, for instance, I had one young person I met. Her brother was a policeman. He joined the party. But she was contemptuous because he was often drunk. You know, so she saw him as this kind of everything a policeman and a party member shouldn't be, but that's what he was. Another party member had studied overseas and encountered Western Marxism because, you know, I mean, they're all brought up to believe that the party embodies, you know, Marxist thought and so on, and openly told me, like, that Chinese Marxism was just all propaganda. These are the kind of tensions in terms of the way the party is seen. So it's not that it is, like, anyone who thinks the party is universally hated in China is an idiot. People who think that it has this unchallenged hold on the minds of the people are equally stupid. The arbitrary behaviour of officials, like, I remember being in a city once with friends, and a property developer had hired folks to dismantle a village very close by, and the villagers were all, then homeless. And this, people were really angry about this. Many of them knew party members. Some of them had family members who were party members. They got on the phone and complained about it. And, you know, it was absolutely clear that their family members were incredibly embarrassed by this. At the same time, Xi Jinping is genuinely popular among a significant proportion of the population for the anti-corruption drive and so on. And so it's really important that socialists, genuine socialists, I don't mean China, but China called socialism, the genuine socialists here in China are able to see, you know, the different elements to the party's rule. On the one hand, repression and even terror are indispensable to its ability to hold power. But actually, most of the time, the means by which it rules is the reality of its power, you know, the sense that economic growth has given people better lives. And of course, the other side of this, which again it's important for us to understand, is that the lack of any safety valve in the system, like elections to hollow parliaments, as we have in the West, means that in any real crisis, a crisis in the system risks becoming, will almost inevitably be a crisis for the party. And so in that sense, its rule is strong, but in a crisis, potentially more fragile.
Another element of China, which the Western media in particular brushes over, it assumes that the party and the government has total control and there's no room for disagreement or protest, is the ability of workers to strike or protest about wages and so on and so forth. And according to the China Labour Bulletin, there have been 590 strikes or protests by Chinese workers in the past 6 months. Now, as you remind us, in a population of 1.4 billion, 590 strikes is not a lot. But on the other hand, it does give us an indication that there is a constant rumble of struggle amongst workers and sometimes, as you say, amongst peasants. It doesn't rise to the level of mass strikes, but neither does it disappear. So what does this tell us about life for workers in China?
Actually, there's a really interesting book came out recently, Manfred Elstrom, I think his name is. The book goes through and argues that working class unrest has both been repressed by the state and accommodated by the state, which is, as Marxists, exactly what we would expect. This is not an inflexible regime. One of the great contributions that one of our former comrades who now lives in another country made, to my understanding, was to point to the willingness and ability of the regime to experiment, to be flexible in dealing with unrest, and so on. So I say that precisely to say that, on the one hand, people who go on strike know that they will face trouble from the police and the local government. On the other hand, that doesn't mean they don't do it. And that 590 strikes or protests is just the ones the China Labour Bulletin finds out about. I would guess thousands that they never hear about as well. So what it tells us, yes, Chinese workers are willing to fight back. You know, it's not like Australian workers, you know, in a much less repressive environment, you know, go on strike or take industrial action every time there's some grievance. It shows us a willingness to fight, and there are many occasions on which those fights are successful and actually then sometimes lead to shifts in government policy. In terms of the reasons that workers fight, again, it's important to see that alongside the very, very real improvement in living standards goes incredibly insecure work, which is often dangerous. In building sites, you know, food delivery services, there's been a lot of strikes and protest actions by food delivery workers. There have been a lot lately. Harassment by bosses, including sexual harassment. One of the huge issues is late payment or non-payment of wages, especially in the lead up to, you know, the major public holidays, you know, the Spring Festival, the National Week, October the 1st. The other thing is that I know that in the lead up to, before Xi Jinping really asserted his control, there was a growing cadre of roaming agitators in China. So workers who had they participated in major strikes, they won something, and then whatever job they had, they became willing to share their experiences with other groups of workers. And it's absolutely clear that there was no formal structure, there was no pulling this cadre together, but those people often did participate in university-run legal centres supporting workers' rights and informing workers of their rights under the law and so on and so forth. A lot of that, those university departments have been closed, a lot of the academics have been victimised and jailed and prosecuted, you know, other activists have been prosecuted, so there's been a real repression of that movement. But there's no question that culture is out there. Not the last time I was in China, the time before, I heard a story which I think is actually not that untypical. So in Guangzhou, which is the old Canton, major city in southern China, I don't know, it's 12, 15 million people, historically a major clothing manufacturing city, a massive, massive, massive industrial city. The clothing industry, much of the clothing industry had been driven out of Guangzhou, but there were still lots and lots of very small semi-sweatshops in this crowded area of southern Guangzhou. And so these sweatshops would all do a bit of a process of clothing manufacture, you know, so some of them would do some stitching, others would be doing dyeing, and there'd be stuff, product being moved all around this area on these little bikes, you know, with massive kind of containers strapped to them. And so the local government decided to crack down on this unsafe, you know, movement of stuff on these kind of electric bikes. And so they started, you know, the police started confiscating bikes, and this created all this anger among the delivery workers. And one day the police made the mistake of confiscating someone's bike at a major intersection. And of course, you know, what happened is they confiscate the bike, you know, there's a verbal fuss, people gather around, other bike riders and delivery people gather around, traffic starts to get held up, other people come out, and there's a riot. Within almost no time, there was a riot. The whole traffic of the area, and I mean, I'm not talking about some minor area, was completely gridlocked, and the riot police were sent in. And the most interesting thing about the riot police being sent in was they went in to rescue the police. They did not go in to beat the crap out of the rioters. And that was seen as a victory. Now, that doesn't turn up in anyone's... I'm sure it turns up in the central government statistics, perhaps. But I think that gives you a sense of life for a lot of workers in China is constantly involves pushing back against police harassment and police regulation, testing the limits, and absolutely a willingness to, sometimes when they see the opportunity for collective action, they will just go for it. Now, I just want to address the other thing you talked about, which is the business about people not being able to think their own thoughts, all that sort of stuff. I mean, it's just the government puts enormous effort into censoring social media precisely because people argue about things and discuss things and criticise the government all the time. And so when the coronavirus epidemic broke out and there was all the stories starting to come out of Wuhan, there was just this flood of criticism, literally flood of criticism on the internet. And when the brave doctor who exposed the virus and criticised his superiors for trying to suppress news of the virus, when he was disciplined, and then when he died, there was just this outpouring of grief and support for this very brave doctor. People are constantly testing the limits of what they can and can't argue. If you go across China, like, the government is engaged in a major homophobic attack on what it calls Sisi men. But China has a very, very vibrant, though often underground, LGBTQI culture. And some cities are known for their liberality towards LGBTQI people. Others, of course, are known for their repression. Activists who say, I'm moving to Chengdu because life will be easier there. And so there's a constant pushing of the boundaries from below.
We're covering a lot of ground here, and I realise that each of these questions probably deserves a podcast episode in their own right. But nonetheless, sure, Let's press on. And I want to talk about the situation for ethnic minorities. Now, it was very trendy in the West until quite recently to focus on the plight of the Tibetans, Now, no one seems to talk about the oppression that they face, and the focus is on the Uyghurs, and that's become very much the focus for Western criticism of China. And just this week, Australia, the US, Britain, and a number of other Western countries have announced that there will be a diplomatic boycott of the Winter Olympic Games in China in February. I'm not sure whether anybody really cares, but it's going to happen. And this is in the name of protesting against the treatment of the Uyghurs. As people here in Australia have already pointed out, if we were going to be consistent, there should be international boycott of Australia for treatment of refugees in mandatory detention or over the case of Indigenous deaths in custody. But of course, the world doesn't work like that. Having said all that, leaving aside the hypocrisy for the moment, what is the situation for ethnic minorities?
Look, it's a really, really complex question, David. I think the first thing to say is, like, if you look at the treatment of Uyghurs in Xinjiang, there's a lot in common with the treatment of Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory. The Northern Territory intervention, the number of people incarcerated, Indigenous people incarcerated in Australia, compared to Uyghurs in Xinjiang, the suppression of Aboriginal languages in schools in the Northern Territory until recently, and so on. There's a lot in common. Even if the situation's worse in Xinjiang, it's worse on a continuum. You know, it's just, and of course, then you've got the treatment of African Americans and so on and so on, and you mentioned refugees. So the hypocrisy of the West is just unbelievable here. The other thing I think to say about the Uyghurs is that David Brophy, who I think many people who listen to this podcast will know and should know, and certainly should read his book, China Panic. He basically says, yes, the treatment of the Uyghurs is absolutely appalling, but some of the stuff that's said in the West is unsubstantiated and almost certainly wildly exaggerated. But that is not to take away at all from the repression that's going on. Okay, the situation of the Uyghurs cannot simply be understood as a question of ethnic minorities. Xinjiang is a border territory, a lightly populated border territory. It's slightly smaller, I think, than Queensland. It's got 5,500 kilometres of national border with 8 other states. So Xinjiang borders Mongolia, Russia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan and India. Right? So it's a massive, massive border territory in an area that China does not feel secure about its control of, including, of course, 5 of those states being Muslim states. Over half of China's territory is contained within 4 similar border or near border provinces, Tibet, Xinjiang, Qinghai, and Neimenggu in Mongolia. And, of course, they are all provinces that have substantial ethnic minority populations. But that half of China's geographical area, those 4 provinces have 60 million people, which is like a tiny proportion of China's population. So I think that you've got to understand Xinjiang partly as, if you like, a border territory issue. And we know the response of the Australian state to Aboriginal people, who are also seen as kind of like inhabiting a lightly populated border area, you know, in terms of, you know, wanting to drive white settlers into the north. They feared Aboriginal people siding with invaders and so on. It's very much a reflection of the same problem. And so the central government is much more repressive towards people in those areas, much more concerned to ensure its absolute dominance, much more sensitive to any hints of rebellion and so on. So I think that's the first thing. There are many other ethnic minorities. And again, when you start to talk about ethnic minorities, the problem is that there's a certain number of recognised nationalities in China. But actually, if you think of an ethnic minority in terms of being a language community, then the number of ethnic minorities in China is absolutely colossal. The Chinese government says, you know, I think it was 92% of the population are Han Chinese. Well, a very large proportion of those Han Chinese don't speak the same language. They, you know, their mother tongue is completely unintelligible to other Han Chinese. only two-thirds of the country now grows up with Han Chinese as their mother tongue. So the national language is a second language for a third of the population. So you've got a variety of experiences. So, for instance, there is a so-called ethnic minority called the Hui. So the Hui are supposedly Han Chinese who are Muslims. They face some, how can I put it, discrimination, but they don't face anything like the repression of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. And you go to any local restaurant strip in China and you'll find a Hui restaurant. That is to say, a halal restaurant. I raise the question of languages because one of the other aspects of the treatment of ethnic minorities in China is that the government has stepped up its attempt to marginalise and basically ultimately get rid of these minority languages. So, I don't know, 6 months or a year ago, they said that in Inner Mongolia, the schools would no longer teach in the local language. And there were mass demonstrations in opposition to this policy. Many of these languages have no written form. Some of them do. But everywhere there is the pushing out of local languages. So Cantonese in Guangdong, for instance, is becoming, like it was historically the dominant, I shouldn't say the dominant language, but it was certainly a dominant language in Guangdong because there's many languages in Guangdong. But Cantonese speakers, like native Cantonese speakers, being taught Cantonese, they're brought up in a Cantonese-speaking family. Again, the proportion is contracting all the time, bit by bit by bit. And so that's a real issue. The Chinese government's gone through a wide range of policies towards ethnic minorities. It's had policies of what you might call positive discrimination. So, for instance, a lot of ethnic minorities were not subject to the one-child policy, which meant that their relative population in the population went up. But, of course, also, too, they had to learn the dominant language and so on. And, you know, it was not necessarily easy for them to get significant positions in the party or government, you know, hierarchy. I think that the way to understand what's going on, to give it an overall focus, so leave aside the border territory issue, is that the government is attempting to homogenise the population. And it's interesting to me because I wrote my PhD thesis on the development of a white Australia policy. And one of the central reasons that Asian people were excluded from the right, coming to live in Australia, was that the government had taken up some of the theories of John Stuart Mill, who argued that if you wanted a stable political regime, you needed to have its incredibly important element to homogeneity, the kind of things that would allow a regime, allow a state to rise above its government, to rise above the petty, what he saw as the petty conflicts of, you know, class, economic conflict and so on. And he included in that race, language, religion, a stable and respected monarchy and so on. And that shaped Australian immigration policy, and still does today, actually. Although the racial element has been tweaked, it still shapes what the way the government thinks about its own immigration policy. I think that idea, although they may not understand it as having its origins with John Stuart Mill, that very, very much shapes China's approach. It wants everyone in China to either be Han or identify with the Han majority, everyone to speak Mandarin Chinese as their language and more as their mother tongue. It's all part of, you know, attempt to have these things that bind the nation and make it easy for the rulers to rule directly rather than rely on ethnic minority, you know, intermediaries.
Thanks for that, Phil. Finally, we're recording this podcast at the beginning of a weekend of demonstrations and protests around the country against the new pact between Australia, the United States and the United Kingdom called AUKUS, which includes the purchase of nuclear power submarines by Australia and a range of other measures, which all of which are absolutely clearly aimed at meeting the military and the cyberspace challenge of China. What should the left in Australia be saying and doing under these circumstances?
Well, of course, I mean, I think it's fairly obvious that this is incredibly dangerous and we need to be arguing against it and mobilising against it. And I think that the thing you started with there, which is this is aimed at containing China, is central. So we need to understand this. I won't explain this in detail because we're running out of time. But what we're dealing here with is the logic of imperialism. So the Americans are absolutely determined that there will be no rival to American power in the world. The Australian government actively supports that, as does the British government and other governments, Japanese. This is an attempt by one imperial power to push back and push down an emerging rival. And, of course, it's this dynamic that has led to two catastrophic world wars in the past hundreds of years. So I think we have to say this is about the imperial dominance of the American-led bloc. Not just America, but the American-led bloc. And I think, to some extent, the left understands that. I think it's important, first of all, it's important we need to say this is aimed at China. And the reason I think it's important to say that is because we need to win the argument that ordinary people in Australia have no interest in containing China. Right? If you do not take up this argument, if you don't take up the China argument, then basically you just leave it to the ruling class and to the militarists to say, oh, China's this great threat to Australia and so on and so on. I mean, how many overseas military bases does America have? What is it, 800? How many does China have? One or two? Who has the greatest influence in Australian politics? Because China has no influence, minimal influence. Britain, America, European countries and so on, and much more influence both in Australia and other countries around the world. The idea that China represents some threat to us is just absolute nonsense. We need to stand up. And also, I think we need to say that attempts to contain China actually strengthen Xi Jinping. They strengthen the Communist Party. They strengthen the force that they pretend to be wanting to liberate China from. I want China to be liberated, but that's the challenge that faces the Chinese working class and the Chinese people. You know, America is not going to liberate China, just as it didn't liberate Afghanistan, it didn't liberate Iraq, it didn't liberate Vietnam, and so on. Okay, so that's that. I think the other thing we have to say, which isn't about China, but it's about Australia, which is, of course, that most of the people on the left think that AUKUS is an attempt by the American military to strengthen their control over the Australian military. And in a sense, we have to fight for some kind of Australian independence. So I think that's just nonsense. The Australian ruling class and Australian governments have had a long history of supporting a great imperial power precisely for their own interests. Before the Second World War, they dragged Britain back into Southeast Asia, promising to strengthen their base in Singapore. This was not a democratic move. They worked to get America more deeply involved in Vietnam. And then as America had to ramp up its, involvement in Vietnam, the Australian government didn't, you know, just left a very modest contingent of troops there. You know, their aim was to keep America, committed to dominance in the region, to protect Australian capitalism and the Australian state. And that's the same here, as David Brophy has pointed out. You know, Malcolm Turnbull started, you know, ramping up and leading this idea that China is this great threat precisely during the Trump regime, when all the Western powers feared that Trump was abandoning allies, going out on his own, and so on, and breaking up that kind of dominant alliance of those the rich Western powers. So I think it's very important we say this is not about American dominance. This is about the capitalist and imperial interests of the Australian ruling class and the Australian state, which has done such awful things in the region. And of course, now we have Australian troops off to the Solomon Islands. I think the final thing that it's got to do is it's got to stand up and say, you know, it's got to fight against the racism that Chinese people and Chinese communities in Australia have faced.
Thanks for that. And for listeners who want to hear you talk at more length on the question of an independent foreign policy, there is actually an earlier podcast entitled Does Australia Need an Independent Foreign Policy, where you address that question in more detail. We're out of time now, Phil. It's been a really rich discussion. There's lots more we can come back and discuss another time, but I'd like to thank you for your input today.
No worries, David. Thanks for it. It's a great fun.